Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the Book of Psalms, so grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McLarty.
Next week is the conference up in Gladeville. If you feel like going to church next Wednesday, don't come here, because we won't be here next Wednesday. Instead, drive up to Hamilton Chapel in Gladeville, Tennessee. It's not that far away.
Conference actually starts Tuesday night, doesn't it?
Conference starts Tuesday night.
Are you teaching this year at the conference hall?
I am Friday morning. Yeah. Let's begin in Psalm 85 tonight. This is a really interesting psalm from a literary perspective because it is broken up into three large categories. The first part of the psalm is a declaration of what God has promised to do for his people. And so the psalmist, one of the sons of Korah, states what God has done for his people as if it was an accomplished fact. Past tense, he declares that God has forgiven his people and that he has delivered his people and that he has restored the captivity of Jacob. But then starting in verse 4, he starts talking about the reality. The reality is, you need to restore us. You need to do the things that you have promised to do for us. Their situation then is similar to the situation that we've looked at in previous Psalms, which is that the Israelites, the southern kingdom, the Judahites, have been taken into Babylon. This is late in their captivity. Perhaps they have been allowed to go back, and yet in those first years of being back in their land, they continued to have to fight in order to build the temple and build the walls. And so there are psalms that come out of that period that are asking God to restore Israel and also to remove his judgment from them. So that might be the period of time that's being referred to here. But the psalm starts with, God has already done it, and then talks about the reality that he hasn't done it yet, and how long are you going to be angry with us? And then the psalmist turns in verse 8 to, I will wait and hear what God will say. So this is a really interesting formula for a psalm, and an interesting way to approach God. You know, I have said for years that when you pray to God, you should pray his word back to him. Tell him what he has already promised you. And then after that, wait and see what he says. Wait and see what his deliverance is going to look like, and whether his answer is yes or no, or just be patient. And it's the patience that kicks in here in verse 8. And I really like the fact that after the transition of bring us your salvation, restore us, deliver us from your indignation, that the psalmist resorts to God's absolute sovereignty and says, now there's nothing I can do but just wait, see what God has to say. The second psalm that we're going to look at tonight, Psalm 86, is a prayer from David that is going to recite themes that we have seen previously from the pen of David, but it is also a good demonstration of how to pray. So let's start at Psalm 85 for the choir director, a psalm of the sons of Korah. And it starts, O Yahweh, you showed favor to your land. He's referring there to the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, the land of milk and honey that God promised to Abraham in perpetuity that belongs to the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. O Lord, you have shown favor to your land. You restored the captivity of Jacob. You forgave the iniquity of your people. You covered all their sin. Selah, pause and think about that. Okay, now, has there been a moment in the history of Israel where we could say that that's all true? I think he was thinking from the perspective of knowing that they were the covenant people and based on the covenant promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He could speak in the past tense and say, these are things that you have done. But in a moment, he's going to demonstrate that it hasn't happened yet. Oh, Lord, you showed favor to your land. You restored the captivity of Jacob. You forgave the iniquity of your people. You covered all their sin. Think about that. You withdrew all your fury, all your anger. You turned away from your burning anger. Now, in a moment, because he's going to say, restore us. You are the God of our salvation. Let your indignation turn away from us. It is clear that they were under the judgment and indignation of God. It's obvious that they were out of their land, that the land had not been restored, nor had Jacob been returned to their promised land. And so he could say, you withdrew all your fury, you turned away from your burning anger as an expectation of what God was going to do based on the promises God had already made, and yet his current situation was, we are not restored. Because verse 4 says, restore us, O God of our salvation. That's Elohim. O Elohim of our salvation, restore us and cause your judgment, your anger, your indignation toward us to cease, to come to an end. Will you be angry with us forever? Will you prolong your anger generation to generation or to all generations? Will you not yourself revive us again, that your people may rejoice in you? Show us your loving kindness, O Yahweh, and grant us your salvation. So their current state, as the psalmist is writing this, is that they are still under what they perceive to be the indignation of God. They are still either in captivity or just recently released, and then they've come back to Jerusalem and seen the destruction of Jerusalem. And he's begging God, how long are you going to be angry with us? Is it just going to go on? And if we're going to be revived, if we're going to be brought back as a nation, brought to life again, then you yourself are going to have to do it. And then your people will rejoice in you. And don't you want that? Don't you want your people to rejoice in you? Well, then you need to show us your loving kindness. You need to show us your salvation. Restore us. Plant us in our land again. And then we will praise you. So the juxtaposition between the first three verses and the next four verses is really, really interesting to me. The fact that it starts with, you have shown favor to your land. You have restored the captivity of Jacob. And yet he says, you need to restore us. You need to revive us. So this particular prayer for the nation starts with God's promises. Then takes to God the reality of their situation. And then in verse 8 says, I will hear what God, Elohim, Yahweh, will say. In other words, now I've laid out my petition. Now I have identified the God I'm speaking to. This is very much like Jesus laying out the model prayer and saying, first recognize the God that you're talking to. He is the Father who is in heaven, and his name is hallowed, and not to be besmirched or taken by you to be used in vain. This is the unique him, the almighty him. Identify him before you ever get to what you want. And that's what the psalmist does. These are your promises to your people. We are in a desperate estate. I will pray to you. I will plead with you that you restore us according to the promise you've made to us. But then in verse 8, you resort back to God is sovereign and he can do whatever he wants to do. I will wait and hear what Yahweh will say. Listen to the confidence. He will speak peace to his people, to his godly ones. It means his saints, the ones that he has chosen, the people who belong to him. He will speak peace to his people. So on what basis can the psalmist say with such confidence, even while they are in this state of disarray, driven out of their land, looking for restoration, feeling the indignation and anger of God on them, how can he say so confidently that that is the God who is going to speak peace to his people? Well, because he has already recited the promises at the beginning, that he knows that God is going to restore his people. He knows what the promise is. He knows that God is going to forgive the iniquity of his people. And he's going to cover their sin. He will speak peace to his people, to his godly ones. And let them not turn back to folly. What an interesting phrase. Let them not become foolish again. Let them not go chase after other gods. Let them not engage in the activity that caused you to drive us out of our land to begin with. And notice that as he resorts to God's sovereignty, he doesn't say, and if you restore us, we'll be good. We won't be silly or foolish anymore. Instead, he recognizes that it is God who has to cause his people not to be foolish anymore. In other words, the only hope any one of us have of not being foolish anymore is if God himself determines to give us the wisdom not to be foolish anymore. He will speak peace to his people, to his saints, to his godly ones, but let them not turn back to folly. Surely, his salvation is near to those who reverence him, who fear him, who recognize him for who he is. His salvation is near to them, I would argue, that the fact that they do reverence him, recognize him at all, have a proper fear for him, is a demonstration that his salvation is already near to them. He is drawing them, he is instructing them, he is restoring them, and his salvation is near to those who fear him, so that glory may dwell in our land. Now again, verse 1 started, O Yahweh, you showed favor to your land. But then there is the current state of affairs, which is that they are driven out of their land. And yet his confidence is that the glory of God is going to dwell again in that land. Verse 10 is a beautiful phrase, loving kindness and truth have met together. Loving kindness and truth. God's loving kindness is the only reason that he would forgive anybody, that he would cover the sins of his people. That is a result of his loving kindness. But God does not just forgive us, cover our sins, and then just let us go back to our folly the way we were. He also causes us to know the truth. It is the loving kindness of God that leads to an understanding of God as proof that his salvation is near to us. You know, in the New Testament, we're told that we're to speak the truth in love. And this is a vital connection. Love, loving kindness, and truth need to be combined together. If you just have love for people and you never tell them the truth, well, then you are taking part in their sinfulness. You're never correcting them. You're never telling them the error of their ways. But it is necessary when you tell the truth of God that you tell it through love. Speak the truth in love, because just the truth can be and has been used as a battering ram to beat people over the head with. There are a lot of religions out there that claim to have the truth, but then just hammer that truth in such a way that it oppresses people. It is necessary when you speak the truth of God, Yahweh, that you speak that truth in love, because it is the loving kindness of God that brought about the knowledge of truth and brings about peace between God and man. Loving kindness and truth have met together, and righteousness and peace have kissed each other. In other words, they're not enemies. They are working in unison, and I argue that righteousness, your understanding of righteousness, and that righteousness comes from God, so that you walk out your life in righteousness, in respect of God. If you do that, that leads to peace. Peace is the natural result of righteousness. If people are truly, genuinely walking after the fear of the Lord, walking in the righteousness that only He can provide, then they have peace with God. But if they don't have that righteousness, then they continue in their folly, which is what led to His indignation in the first place. So the opposite of God's indignation is peace with God, which comes as a result of knowing the truth of God's righteousness and then Him imposing that righteousness on His people, His saints, the ones He has chosen. Verse 11. Truth springs from the earth, and righteousness looks down from heaven. Those are beautiful picture words. The idea is that God is kind of leaning over a banister in heaven, looking down on His people on earth. And He is the righteousness that looks down from heaven. And as a result of His righteousness emanating from heaven down onto the earth, then truth springs up in response back to Him. So truth springs from the earth, and righteousness looks down from heaven. It's like a picture of clouds that send down rain. And then the sun comes out and that rain evaporates and it goes up and becomes clouds. It's that constant cycle of watering the earth with the righteousness of God that produces truth on earth that is then raised back up in the knowledge of Him. It's a great picture. Indeed, the Lord Yahweh will give what is good. Indeed, Yahweh will give us what is good. How can He say that so confidently? Because He started by saying, Yahweh, You showed favor to Your land. You restored the captivity of Jacob. You forgave the iniquity of Your people. You covered their sin. That's all really good stuff. And His expectation is that Yahweh will do exactly what He said He will do. Indeed, the Lord will give what is good, and our land will yield its produce. Righteousness will go before God and will make His footsteps into a pathway, into the way that we should walk. In other words, God, in leading His people, goes forward in righteousness, and then we, following Him, walk in His footsteps, because He has already created the pathway for our life. When I was a kid, growing up in Michigan, my dad used to put on his snow boots and go out and walk in the new snow. And it would make these big footprints. And I, as a kid, would try to always walk in my dad's footprints. That way I didn't get buried in the snow. It's the same image here. God in his righteousness is demonstrating the pathway that we ought to take. That is a righteous pathway. And so then his footsteps, the path that he makes, is the path that we, his saints, his elect, we follow in that path and make it into a way. That's Psalm 85. But then Psalm 86 is also a prayer. This is a prayer from David, and it is going to touch on themes that we have actually seen from David's pen before. Once again, David is in trouble, and he's running for his life. We don't know which particular occasion caused him to write this particular psalm, but you know there were several instances when he had to run for his life, even from his son who was trying to take over his throne. And so he starts in the same manner as the prayer we just read and as the Lord's Prayer. He starts by identifying the God he's talking to, and he worships and praises that God for who he is. He does all of that before he gets to "help me." He starts by blessing, by speaking well of, by eulogizing the God that he is praying to, and points out that he is the only God that exists, unlike all the other so-called gods. "Incline your ear, O Yahweh, and answer me. For I am afflicted and needy. Preserve my soul, for I am a godly man." Chassid, the same word that we saw in the previous psalm that was translated as "your godly ones," your saints, people who are following after you. And so he says, "Preserve my soul. I am somebody who follows after you. I am one of your saints. I am one of your people," which David certainly knows because he was anointed as a child and told he was going to be the king. And then even as the king, he sinned so badly with Bathsheba and the death of Uriah the Hittite. And then the prophet of God comes to him and says, "God's going to forgive you." So he knows that he is one of the chosen people of God, and he says, "Preserve my soul," which I think means "preserve my life, and preserve my soul, for I am one of your people. O you, my God, save your servant who trusts in you." I think that's the same statement made a second time. These are parallel statements. "Preserve my soul, for I'm a godly man. O you, my God, save your servant who trusts in you. Be gracious to me, O Lord. For to you I cry all day long." I don't think there he means like weeping, shedding tears kind of crying. He's saying, "I call out to you. I raise my voice. My prayer comes to you all day long. Make glad the soul of your servant. For to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul." In other words, I know that my life, my soul is in your hands, and I am glad to come and cry to you, knowing that you will make glad the soul of your servant, because to you, O Lord, I lift up my prayer, my soul, my being, everything that I am. For you, Lord, are good and ready to forgive. Boy, David knows that one. He knows that this is the God who is willing to forgive him because he was guilty of sin to death. For you, Lord, are good and ready to forgive. And you are abundant in loving kindness to all those who call upon you. Give ear, O Lord, to my prayer, and give heed to the voice of my supplications. In the day of my trouble, I shall call upon you, for you will listen to me, for you will answer me. There is no one like you among the Elohim, among the gods, small g, O Lord, nor are there any works that any of these other gods have done, nor are there any works like yours. Not only are you the only God that exists, but you're the only God who has proven that he exists by the things that you have already done. So he is identifying the God he's talking to. You are Yahweh. You are Israel's God. You are the forgiving God. You are the gracious God. You are the righteous judge, and you are the God who created heaven and earth. You're the only one who has those kind of works to commend yourself, and all the other Elohim, all the other gods are no one, are nothing. Verse 9, all nations whom you have made shall come and worship before you, O Lord, and they shall glorify your name. That's the God you are. All those other nations who are chasing other gods, who are chasing after gods who are not gods, ultimately are going to know who you are, and they are going to flock to Israel, flock to Jerusalem. They're going to bring the wealth of their nations to Jerusalem to come and worship the only God who is. All nations whom you have made shall come and worship before you, O Lord, and they shall glorify your name. For you are great, and you do wondrous deeds, and you alone are God. Okay, so he's taken that long just to identify the God he's talking to. David is expressive about the God he is speaking to, the God of Israel, the only true God, the one he trusts in. And he begins in verse 11 with, "Teach me your way, O Yahweh, and I will walk in your truth." So again, very similar to what we read in the Psalm from the Sons of Korah. In order for anybody to walk in the truth of God, God has to teach them. He has to show you what his truth is, what his righteousness is, because you by your nature don't know that. You in your flesh cannot figure him out, nor can you determine what genuine righteousness is. He has to demonstrate his truth to you, and then you're able to walk in the path that he has laid according to his truth. And unite my heart to fear your name. There's that reverence thing again. The same way that the sons of Korah talked about the necessity of reverencing God, David said, "I will walk in your truth, and you will unite, you will firm up my heart to fear your name. I will give thanks to you, O Lord my God, with all my heart, and will glorify your name forever. For your loving kindness toward me is great, and you have delivered my soul from the depths of Sheol. From the place of the dead, you have guaranteed me a better eternal inheritance than just the grave." Now again, I'm so fascinated by all of this, because in a moment, verse 14, he's going to say, "Arrogant men have risen up against me, and there's a band of violent men who are trying to kill me. They're trying to do me damage, God." And before he ever gets to that, knowing, recognizing who he's speaking to, he says, "I thank you." He says, "Teach me your way so that I can walk uprightly in your truth. Bind my heart to the fear of your name. I'll glorify your name forever. And your loving kindness toward me is great." Granted, I'm running from arrogant men right now, and I'm off my throne, and people are trying to kill me. Okay, granted, but your loving kindness toward me is great. Are you able to say that in your times of trouble? Are you able to say that when everything's against you? Are you still able to look at God for who He is and recognize that His grace and His loving kindness toward you is great? Everything you know, everything you think, everything you have, the clothes on your back, every hair on your head, everything that you are is a gift from God that He has granted you through His grace and loving kindness. Therefore, even in times of trouble or dismay or upset in this lifetime, it does not change the characteristic of God's loving kindness, which is bountiful toward you. And therefore, He deserves to be worshiped and praised and thanked no matter the circumstances. David's under bad circumstances here, as we're about to see. And yet he declares, before he ever asks God for any kind of deliverance or protection, he says, I thank you and I glorify your name and I recognize that your loving kindness toward me is great, especially because I know that when I die, I'm going to be in your presence and you're not going to leave my soul in Sheol, in the place of the dead. That fact alone is proof and demonstration of how great your loving kindness is, regardless of the circumstances of my life right here and right now. Then finally, after 13 verses, David finally gets around to asking God, O God, arrogant men have risen up against me, and a band of violent men have sought my life. And they have not set you before them. The indication there is, because I am the king that you have put on the throne, they are violently opposed to me because they don't know you. They have not set you before themselves. They do not worship you. They do not reverence or fear you. They are violent men, and therefore they are also enemies of yours, and they are seeking my life. And they hate me, apparently, because I am a man of God. But you, O Lord, are a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abundant in loving kindness and truth. There's that combination again of loving kindness and truth. The previous psalm said loving kindness and truth have met together. David says that you, O Lord, are a God who is merciful and gracious. You are slow to anger. You are overflowing, abundant in loving kindness and in truth. Now, I don't want to spend too much time pounding away at this, but I just want to say one more time, you cannot separate the loving kindness of God from the truth of God. The only way that you are going to know anything, the truth about God, is because He's going to reveal it to you by His loving kindness, by His grace. But you cannot have the loving kindness of God without also the truth of God. It's the same way that Jesus said to the woman who was caught in adultery. When He said, "Where are your accusers?" And she said, "There's none, Lord, except you." And He said, "Neither do I accuse you." Now, if He had stopped right there, that would have been nothing but loving kindness. Okay, you're guilty, you're caught, and I don't accuse you. But He didn't stop there. He also said, "Now go and sin no more." He also put that responsibility on her. He also told her the truth. Because grace and loving kindness from God is always accompanied by the truth of God, the teaching of God, the expectations of God, who God is, the holiness of God, the righteousness of God, the judgment of God. All of those are part and parcel of the loving kindness of God. And so much of modern Christianity, okay, I'm not going to go down this rabbit trail too far, but so much of modern Christianity emphasizes the loving kindness of God without ever getting to the truth part. And they just say God is love and He's all love and He doesn't really care what you do. Love, love, love. He'll forgive you. Don't worry. And he loves everybody. And Jesus died for everybody with no distinction or particularity because he's just so loving. He just loves everybody so much. And so they emphasize this idea of the love of God and never get around to the truth of God. But the more you know about the truth of God, the more you'll be astounded at the loving kindness of God. The more you know about who you are and who he is, the more you know about your own depravity and his own love toward you anyway, the more astounding that becomes the longer you live in it and grow in it, and the more you recognize the loving kindness of God because you understand the truth of God. You can't separate those two. We've seen two psalms tonight that tie those two concepts, those two ideas together. You, O Lord, are a God merciful. Thank God for that.
Amen.
And gracious, slow to anger, and abundant in loving kindness and truth. Turn to me and be gracious to me. O grant your strength to your servant, and save the son of your handmaid. Show me a sign for good. In other words, save me. Save my soul. Do the things I'm crying out to you for. Demonstrate your goodness to me. Show me a sign for good so that those who hate me might see it and be ashamed because they didn't know you, because they didn't put you before themselves. And therefore, if you deliver me from them, it's going to be a sign that you are the God of Israel, that you are my God, that you are the delivering and saving God, and that will be a shame to them because they're the ones who don't know you. In other words, justify yourself, demonstrate yourself, deliver me through some good sign, and that will shame your enemies. They're going to see it and they're going to be ashamed because you, O Yahweh, have helped me and have comforted me. So David began with the God he's talking to. He showed that he had a knowledge of God and a knowledge of the history of God. And he knows that he is a slow to anger, gracious, loving, kind, true God. And he goes through all of that before he finally gets to, okay, now here's my ask. My ask is, there are men chasing me, seeking my life. I would have started with that. That would have been my opening salvo. Oh God, people are trying to kill me, help me. But David took the time to identify the goodness, the grace, the knowledge of God, and then got to not only deliver me, but deliver me for your name's sake. Not just deliver me because my life is so precious to me, but deliver me so that those who hate you will see the reality of you and be ashamed that they don't know you. I mean, even in the ask, it was glorify yourself by what you do for me. That's a really, really good prayer. Mm-hmm. And a really instructive prayer. You know, this Friday at the conference, the assignment they've given me, the topic they've given me, is to teach on sovereignty and prayer. And I'm happy to do that. I've been thinking about prayer a lot lately because of my preparation to teach about sovereignty and prayer at the conference. And I think that psalm right there, well, actually the two psalms that we looked at tonight, are both beautiful prayers based on the knowledge of God's sovereignty, recognizing who he is and what he is like, having a knowledge of him, and then coming to pray to him, and the whole time recognizing that he is in the enterprise of glorifying himself so that even his protection of his people, even his raising up and teaching of his people is all done so that truth is reflected back to him as his righteousness is coming down from heaven. And even in the things, the day-to-day things, the deliverance things, that he is still getting glory for himself in the way that he is accomplishing the things he has promised to accomplish. Sovereignty is vital to prayer. The longer I am reading the Bible, the longer I am teaching the Bible, and the deeper I get into these Psalms, the more I see that the prayers of David are based in the knowledge of who God is. And I think that's a great impetus and reason and way to pray.
Amen.
Amen.
Questions about that? Comments?
I think slow to anger is one of my personal favorite qualities of God.
Slow to anger?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's been a benefit of that.
Yeah. Because if you're anything like me, you need him to be slow to anger.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, Q&As, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.